Yeah.
Red broom, something like that.
Among many others.
I think I should put in a separate
pot. Yeah. Oh, birds of prey, I'm a snake.
That's a better one. That's probably it.
Hey, a couple things I want to mention. First of all, the homework. Those of you that were gone last week, which was most of you, I don't think picked it up, but what we're doing is the classification of those soils that I gave you the information for on the colored sheets back a month or two ago. We did that indoor lab on the developing interpretations based on soil morphological, chemical, physical characteristics. So what you're going to be doing is classifying those soils using taxonomy. And what I told the folks that were here on Thursday who got started on it is I'd encourage you to work with somebody else because it's a little bit easier, I think, if you have a opportunity to maybe discuss, argue, do that sort of thing as you go through it. But it probably is helpful. And if that's the case, instead of everybody turning in the homework assignment, in other words, avoiding duplication, if you work with somebody, just turn in one of the assignment and put both your names on it. Okay? And that's supposed to be due a week from today. So you got about a week to work on it. The other thing I was going to mention, the fourth exam is Thursday. And so we'll have it at 1:30, you know, in this room. And then what I'd like to do, I think the weather's going to be pretty nice. And I know that after tests, people aren't real interested in doing a whole lot related to the class. I think it's that feeling you get after you just download all the information you got stored in your brain. It leaves everybody mentally exhausted. But what I'll do is just kind of leave it open. I think the weather is going to be nice, so if you need to do some outdoor work on your project, might be a good time for that. Some of you might want to work on that classification exercise, in which case, you know, we can just stay in here and do that, and then I can open the lab up in case some of you want to do some work down there as well. Hand texturing and looking at soil color and that kind of stuff. So it's just sort of an open lab period after the exam. And we'll take a little bit of time on Thursday morning, because I know you guys will have lots of questions by then. And you can take a look at the old test online, and if you have questions on that, we can talk about it Thursday morning. Let's see, the other thing, on the schedule for here, I think I mentioned with the projects that we were going to present them in lab, not this week, but next week. And I think rather than doing that, I would like to try for one last field trip, because so many people missed the other trip that we went up to the experimental forest. So would like to go up on Moscow Mountain for lab next week, all right? And so there won't be any kind of presentation. But the projects themselves are, I think on the syllabus I have the day wrong. It says Monday, May 7th, and I think it's Monday, May 6th. So it's the Monday of finals week. So 2 weeks from yesterday. Yeah?
Our final's not actually until Tuesday though, right?
The final is not till Tuesday. That's right. And what I mentioned about these projects, there's actually, I don't care if you turn it in on Monday or Tuesday, but I'd even be willing to go till Wednesday, but I need to have them by then in order to get them graded. So, you know, here's the other thing. Because of the late start that everybody got, I'm sort of mulling over this idea of maybe not having the final and allowing people to, God, that got everyone's attention. instead of that, at this stage, I would much rather have everybody kind of focus on the project and getting that written up and do a good job on that, and then just leaving the final out of the mix in terms of your grade. And if that creates a hardship for somebody, let me know, and I haven't completely decided yet, but I'm sort of leaning that direction right now. Wipe that smile off your face. God. What? What was that?
I said we can probably convince you pretty easily.
Well, I don't see too many people that act bummed out about it, so I suspect it's not.
Need your yard mowed like all summer long?
No, that's the beauty of our yard. We don't have to mow it.
What is the test cover from what order to what order?
Okay, so the test on Thursday will cover everything from oxisols up through today, which is going to be alfasols. Yeah, because the last test we had gelisols, histosols, spodosols, and andosols, so oxisols through today, okay? Let's see, what else? Yeah, that's all I can think of for the moment, but the other thing about these projects, if you haven't gotten started on it, you really need to do it as soon as you can, because what I want to, you know, going out and doing the digging is only part of it, and obviously that's a lot of work, if those of you who've done it can attest to, but what I'm really more concerned about is how you put all this together. And this, I guess, the project is your opportunity to show how you can take the concepts in this class and apply them to something that you see in the field. And so that's something that probably just takes a little bit of time stewing over it and thinking about it. So give yourself plenty of time to do that. Okay, let's see here. So what we're going to do this morning is I'm going to go through the alfasols, and then on Thursday we'll do the inceptisols, and the next Tuesday that'll leave us with the final soil order, which is the entosol. So one thing about these, we're getting down to the point where if you go through the keys, you know, a lot of these soils have already keyed out on the basis of having oxic horizons and andic soil properties and so on. So we're kind of getting into the what I would consider to be the more of the garbage can categories, where a lot of things have already come out in another taxonomic order. And in fact, if you look at this is the keys from taxonomy, and here you see what they have for alfasols. Obviously pretty simple definition, you know, the other soils that do not have a plagon epipeton, and I have no idea why that is, but the main thing I think is item number one here. It says have either an argillic, candic, or natric horizon, or number two, a fragipan that has clay films that are 1 millimeter or more thick. But for the most part, I think the real concept is item number one there. You have this subsurface zone of clay accumulation. And it can be an argillic, candic, or natric horizon. I would say that argillic horizons are certainly going to be the most common one there. Now, let me get rid of this and then go to the keys, our abbreviated keys. And if you look on here, it's a little bit different. What I put here for alfasols, it says moderately leached soils with a subsurface zone of clay accumulation and greater than or equal to 35% base saturation. Now, the idea here is, you remember the ultisols, subsurface zone of clay accumulation, less than 35% base saturation. Alfasols would be the less leached counterpart to that, or maybe less weathered if you want to think of it that way. So they still have the clay accumulation, but higher base saturation. So maybe in terms of fertility, you think about the alfasols as being a little bit higher level of native fertility associated with them. And if we go to the general description, what I just said, moderately leached soils that have relatively high native fertility. For the most part, these are soils that form under forest, but this is not always the case. There are some, and we'll see a couple of examples, that have actually formed in the absence of forest cover. But I think those really would be the exception rather than, more of the exception than the rule, if you think about them mostly in the U.S. and even globally. The Alfasols are about 10% of the ice-free land area, and you can see they're pretty widely distributed all over North America, South America, Europe, into Asia, Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, Australia, Southeast Asia. So not certainly not limited in terms of geographic extent. And if you look in the U.S., you get this type of a pattern where the biggest concentration of alfasols is going to be in the Midwest, or what we think about typically as the Corn Belt. And then you'll notice that the alfasols also extend down here into Texas, and you get a couple of these darker bands indicating that alfasols are the dominant soils. And you know, if you look out here, this part of West Texas, and you think about this idea of forming under forest, well, you go to that part of West Texas and you sometimes have to look pretty hard to find a tree anywhere. So these are kind of the exceptions, the ones in the high plains here. And then a lot of the alfasols that you see scattered in the western United States are going to be at probably mid to higher elevations, where you have the more rainfall, and therefore you get the forested areas associated with the mountains. But you can see that they're really, it's hard to find any state that they're absent. Even North Dakota, if you look carefully in the western side of North Dakota, they got a few alfasols there. And interestingly enough, up here in New England, Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire, Massachusetts, not too many alfasols up there, but most of the other states have a pretty good share of them. And in the U.S., it's about 14%. The other note on here, the alfasols support about 17% of the world's population. So that's a pretty high proportion. As far as maybe related to that, it says combination of generally favorable climate and high native fertility makes alfasols fairly productive soils, both agriculturally and for silviculture use. So generally, they are pretty favorable soils for cultivation or forestry. The classification of them, look right here, there are five suborders, and you can see the way that they come out. These are climate-based. You've got the wetlands, first of all, the aqualfs. The cryalfs would be the cold, or alfasols, those with a cryic regime. Ustalfs, those would be the alfasols with an ustic regime. Xeralfs, these are the alfasols with the xeric regime. And finally, the eudalfs, which would be those with the eudic regime. As far as where they are in the U.S., here's a map, and it's a little bit older information, but you notice in the eastern United States, the two colors that you see there are green and blue. The blue are the aqualfs, and the green are the eudalfs. And a lot of this Corn Belt area in here, you can see, is kind of a mix of eudalfs and aqualfs. When you start getting west of the 100th meridian, you've got the ustic regime, so this orange color would be the ustalfs, and then the purple color would represent some of the higher elevations in the Rocky Mountains. Those would be the cryalfs. And then finally, when you get into California, primarily parts of Oregon, Washington, and even a little bit into Idaho, the xeralfs would be the dominant form of alfasols.
It looks like in the Midwest, it's really following a river.
Well, you can see the Mississippi River, and they're definitely, you have a lot of the alfasols along that corridor.
Would some of that be transported as well then?
Probably not so much. I think where you're seeing the alfasols here is not in the Mississippi River floodplain or the bottomlands. It's more in the upland areas. Well, go back here. If you look at the suborders and how they would be arranged in one of our diagrams, as I said, it's all climatic. You've got poorly drained or the wet ones, and then dry down in the right-hand corner and cold over there. So the cryalfs, aqualfs, the drier varieties of alfasols would be xeralfs and ustalfs, and then the eudalfs are kind of in the middle there. Few examples here for you to look at. This is one of these topographically challenged areas, central Missouri, and you can see pretty flat landscape. And if you look carefully, you'll notice the water sitting here in the landscape. This is in springtime, and these are pretty wet soils. You can see the residue from last year's corn crop, and that's what a lot of these soils are used for, but they are pretty wet. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. The classification on here is an alba qualf, so you can see the wet alpha sols, and then ALB, the formative element for what? Yeah, like an albic horizon. And here's one example of an alba qualf, and you can see the horizon designations here. This one's cultivated, so it's got an AP horizon, an A. Here's the E horizon that would, in this case, I guess, qualify as an albic horizon. It doesn't look that white here. And there's a BT. You notice that the horizon sequence here is very similar to what we saw in the ultisols. And I kind of think of these two soil orders as being counterparts to one another, with the ultisols being the more highly weathered, more highly leached variety, and the alfasols being the less highly leached and less weathered variety. The classification on here, you notice it's a mollic alba qualf. And as it turns out, if you look at some of the alfasols, they actually have mollic epipedons. It's not that common, but they can have a mollic epipedon or something that's very close to it. And many of these might be found in the areas where you've kind of had this boundary that goes back and forth between forest and the prairie soils. And that's probably part of the reason for it. These soils, alba qualf, would be mentioned, they're relatively high fertility, high base saturation, but what would the problem be with ag production, for example, in these things? It's not the fertility so much, but drainage, they're wet. And that's really the major land use consideration with these things. So most of them require some sort of artificial drainage to lower the water table. Now, I'm going to go down to north central Texas. So this is kind of the high plains, and here's an example of one of the alfasols from down there. What do you notice about the color of this thing? It doesn't show up quite so well on here, but what's that? Well, yeah, you can see the layers in here, but this actually has a much redder color. And this is a geographic pattern that you see, because alfasols go from the Canadian border all the way down into Mexico. One of the things you'll notice as you go from north to south, and this is especially the subsoil colors where you have the BT horizon, they go from being brown, like we would expect to see up here, to much redder hues as you get down further south. And the reason for that is that you start seeing a sort of a different type of iron oxide mineralogy. And you remember, I think we talked about the different iron oxides and the colors that they impart. Which iron oxide gives soils the red color? Goethite would be the brown, and brown or yellow colors. Remember hematite? Okay, and that's the one that really imparts that bright red color. And its formation and stability is favored in soils that come from warmer climates, warmer temperature regimes. So that's why as you go further south, you tend to see redder and redder soils. And it's really apparent in these alfasols. So this guy is found in Texas and parts of Oklahoma. Notice the horizonation again, A, E, BT, very, very typical, except this one didn't form under forest, at least not at any time in the recent past. But it still ends up just by virtue of not having the characteristics of anything else that we've encountered in the Keys, it comes out as being an alfasol. There are some trees associated with it, post oak and blackjack, but it's, if you see these types of landscapes, it's not what you would consider a forest. Looks a little bit more savanna like where the trees are pretty widely spaced out, and quite a few grasses in these things. Notice the classification on this: fine, mixed, active, thermic, eutic, paleostalph. And that we've encountered this term pale before. Remember what it means, or the connotation there? Typically it means old, and as when we see it with a soil, since it's not really about age specifically, it reflects the amount of development. And generally speaking, when you get into something, at least in the alpha soils where it's just in a pale great group like we see here, it means that there's a pretty strong increase in clay when you go from the E into the BT horizon, and also that the BT horizon extends down usually to a fairly deep depth, or more than what you might typically see. It's a little difficult to see the scale on here, but we're only looking at about 2.5 feet to the bottom of the pit there, but that BT horizon probably goes down quite a bit further. And the note here, the texture of the red argillic BT horizon is clay, sandy clay, or clay loam, with somewhere around 40% clay in it. We go back up north, notice the difference in color. We're back to the browns. This is from up in Michigan, one of these glaciated areas, and this thing is formed in calcareous glacial till. And because of that, since it's glaciated, they're relatively young soils, but you still have, they've been around forming long enough to get a BT horizon, even though it's not a particularly thick one in this case. It's cultivated soil, so the horizon sequence AP, E, and a fairly thin BT horizon, BC and C horizon down there in the bottom. But notice, what's the soil moisture regime here? Eutic. Any evidence of carbonates in that? No, long gone, and that part of that is directly attributable to the fact that it is a eutic moisture regime, and you generally don't find carbonates in those soils. And once you get the carbonates out, that's what allows the clays to start to move and the formation of the BT horizon. This is also, these soils are native vegetation in this case would have been hardwood forests, and they mentioned beech, sugar maple, and when cleared, the variety of crops, corn, small grains, and so on. And even some of these guys require tile drainage in order to get rid of excess water. Here's an example from, one other thing here. Note the classification here, typic haplodelph. Not a whole lot you can pull out of that name, but you know, since it's an alpha sol, it's got what kind of horizon in it? Well, it's got a zone of clay accumulation, or because of the lack of anything else, the hapla in there implies that it's just a plain old argillic horizon. It's not a candic horizon or a natric horizon. Okay, southeastern Idaho. This is in Caribou County, some pretty high elevation soils, I think about 6,000 to 8,000 feet. And you can see the forest is kind of mixed with some sagebrush, grasslands, kind of depending on the aspect there. Annual precip down there, I believe, is about 25 inches, so not a whole lot more than what we get here in Moscow, but because of the higher elevation, cooler temperatures, it's probably a little more effective precip, and you do get trees. The common species of that you find down there, subalpine fir, Doug fir, Akistoma, but not really productive forest by North Idaho standards, just because of the cool temperature. And notice the label on here, haplocryalph. So these would be the alpha sols with the cryic temperature regime. And you remember that's mean annual soil temperature between 0 and 8 degrees C plus cold summers. So these things never really warm up. And here's the soil profile. You can see the horizons on there. The pattern kind of repeats itself. So it's got a little bit of an O up there, then an A, an E, not a real well-developed E, but BT horizons there. So kind of the same type of sequence that we've seen in most of the others. And this one is a fine loamy mixed super active typic haplocryalph. So once again, you see the great group of a haplocryalph in this case. And all that means that it's got an argillic horizon rather than a candic or natric horizon. One other note here, if you look at the family, fine loamy, everybody knows what that means, right? Mixed mineralogy, super active, you know what that means. What's missing from the family that you typically expect to see in there? You got particle size, mineralogy, activity class, and normally we see soil temperature. How come it's missing here? Yeah, because it comes out at the suborder. So in this case, since it's a cryalph, we've already said something about the temperature regime. And you might notice in these families, many times one of the components will be missing, or you don't see it there, and usually the reason for that is because it's something that has come out at the higher levels of the system, suborder, great group, subgroup, perhaps. This particular example, it mentions a limestone, or loss over limestone residuum, and it looks like we're starting to get some limestone rock fragments in there, but there's been enough leaching through this thing that the calcium carbonate's deep enough that clay accumulates. Yeah, Lee?
Is soil moisture residuum missing from that?
You don't see it in there, and this is typical when you get a cryic temperature regime. In most cases, the implication is going to be that it's probably a eutic moisture regime. I don't know if that's necessarily the case here, but I guess the rationale is that the cryic temperature regime really has a much stronger influence than the moisture regime. So I suspect down there it's probably on the wet end of Xeric, or it could possibly be even a eutic moisture regime. I'm not sure in this case. But the cryalphs come out second in the key to the suborders. So. But that's the idea why we don't see the moisture regime specifically listed there. The note here, very limited ag potential because of short growing season, so that most of the land use associated with some timber production, watershed, recreation, and a little bit of livestock grazing on these. Okay, and the last example here is the Fragi Xeroff landscape, and this is from eastern Latah County. And I think this is the soil profile that goes with it, the Santa series. Very similar to what we looked at up in the experimental forest. And if you remember that out by the Beulah Cemetery, we looked at the former research site, that this is where Santa soils are found. And a lot going on in this particular soil. You can see the horizons there. We start to get a little bit different because you got this business of two different loess layers in here. So the younger loess up here, kind of an A and a BW horizon. And this one's been cleared, but under forest vegetation, of course, there would be an O horizon. And then here's this older paleosol down here. Notice the BTXB. So the T indicates clay accumulation. The X indicates it's a fragipan, and then the little B indicates the fact that it's buried. So the idea here, this is the modern day soil up top from the E horizon up to the surface, and then here's the old buried soil, or the paleosol. And we talked a little bit about the hydrology, and I'll show you a little bit more about that. Yeah, Hannah?
Is it like, because of the X, is it kind of like that's fragile, it's like a fragipan area, but can it be like, it doesn't look very like it would be hard or?
Well, you might change your, it may not look like it, but it is. Now you guys dug a little bit through at least the upper part of those when they were wet, and you could definitely feel the difference, right? You get down there and it, shovel didn't go in very well. And once they dry out, it's even more noticeable. Very, very difficult. Even with a backhoe, unless you have a real big one, you get down in this stuff and you can actually lift the backhoe off the ground a little bit because it's so difficult to get through that stuff. And really, in terms of the land use and all those types of considerations, that's the dominant feature of these soils. So even though the horizonation is a little bit different in this thing, you kind of see the similarities as far as the, you don't have a Moloch epipedon. You've got an A horizon up there, but like a lot of forest A horizons, it's not really that dark or thick. So it would probably by default qualify as an ochric epipedon, and that would be common in the alpha sols. This probably represents a cambic horizon, that BW, and that's not something you typically associate with alpha sols. But down here, this would be the argillic or the fragipan, and well, both of those things. So that's kind of what makes it fall into that alpha sol category. And this E horizon, I don't know that that would qualify as an albic. It might. I'm not sure in this case. Yeah, Kendall.
So how can you call that fragipan a berry label versus just a different sort of parent material?
Okay, that's a good question. Why do you not put a 2 in front of it, for example? The idea is that this is loss up here, and this was loss parent material. So the parent material is not different in terms of the texture or the mineralogy. What's different is the age of it. And so once upon a time, this was closer to the land surface, and it was the actively forming B horizon. And then it got buried by that upper part of the soil or the younger loss. So it's still the same parent material, but it's a different age. Yeah, usually with volcanic ash, you'll have both the underneath, you'll use the indicator, usually a 2 or a 3, that it's a different parent material, and also that it's buried. And if you think about what we saw up in the experimental forest, the upper part of this, a lot of times, is going to have volcanic ash mixed in there to varying degrees, and it's not enough or thick enough to make it an andesol. But notice the classification there at the subgroup level is a vitrandic fragiseralf. So the vitrandic means that it's got volcanic glass in it and some characteristics of an andesol, but not enough to qualify as a andesol. And the other part, fragiseralf instead of a haplozeralf, and there's where you see the fact that the fragipan is present, and of course the xeric moisture regime. Coarse silty mix, superactive, frigid. Okay, I had a couple other images that I was gonna, the supplemental stuff, and I wanted to go through those real quickly, but this is the map on top of the alpha sol suborders. And you remember the green was representative of the eudalfs, and the blue color was the aqualfs. And this below is a map of the Corn Belt. And I guess I throw this in here just to show that a lot of the Corn Belt, at least this part of it in here, is really alpha sol country. And in fact, a lot of it is the aqualf country, or the wet ones. And because of that, there are a lot of wet soils there, and many of these qualify as being hydric soils. And this map here, you can see the same area in here with the blue and kind of that purplish pink color. And those are, they represent pixels that have a very high percentage, or relatively higher percentage, of hydric soils or wet soils in there. And the idea is that you'd think, just looking at this, you know, hydric soils are basically soils that are in aquic suborders like aqualfs or histosols that are poorly drained would all qualify as being hydric soils. They're very wet soils, and it's a little surprising that you end up with this region of very wet soils that becomes part of the most productive corn-producing area on Earth. You know, it doesn't seem like the most likely location. And the only reason that those two have been able to go together is because of what you see illustrated in this picture. Can anybody tell what you're looking at there? See all these? Yeah, you're looking at tile drainage. And this, you know, they say barbed wire and the six shooters, what tamed the West? Well, tile drainage is what tamed the Corn Belt area, because so many of these soils are wet. And in order to be productive for something like corn, corn's kind of a finicky crop. It doesn't like to be wet, it doesn't like to be cold. So part of the secret of having good corn yields is to have a well-drained soil that doesn't have a high water table in it and warms up a little bit faster in the spring. So they drain these things, and you drive around in this area and you'll always see these pipes sticking out of the subsoil and draining this excess water away.
How do the tile fields change the soil aside from, you know, the water
temperature? Well, they probably turn what would be a poorly or moderately well-drained soil into a better drainage category. As far as the morphological changes, I suspect there's probably been a little bit of loss of organic matter from them because of the better drainage. But part of that's agricultural use as well, so it's a little hard to separate those out. So I don't really know that you'd see a noticeable change in morphology. Many of these will have redoxomorphic features in them, but those are something that they normally don't go away once you drain the soil. They kind of persist there for a long time. At least, and we're talking about decades here, or maybe 100 years, a little bit more, 200 in some cases. But
how much do they contribute to soil leaching?
Soil leaching?
Of the nutrients?
The tile drains? Well, there's been a lot of work done looking at what comes out of these tile drains and goes into these surface waters. And there's a lot of stuff in there like atrazine and some of these herbicides that are widely used, at least detectable amounts. It's pretty difficult to find any water in this part of the country that doesn't have at least traces of something like atrazine in it. So it definitely contributes to, it's going to have an impact on water quality. And this is our Santa profile again. I just wanted to show you this diagram, kind of how the different LUS units are interacting here, where the L1 represents the younger LUS, which is probably, let's say, 15,000 years old. And then the L2 is the older LUS unit. I got to say, the geologists were not very imaginative when they came up with the names for these, L1, L2, and so on. Plus, think about this. If there's another big deposit of LUS, what are you going to call that one? L0 or L-1? I don't think they really came up with a very good system for labeling these things. What's that?
So they won't be around to name it.
Well, yeah, it's going to be somebody else's problem, exactly. But anyway, so, you know, this up here, the A, the BW horizon, and probably part of this E horizon are in the part of the L1 or the younger LUS. The L2 is the 40,000 year old stuff, clearly down here, and that's the Fragipan and the Argillic horizon. But in between, you kind of get this zone that is often referred to as a welded soil, where it's pretty difficult to tell if this is the older or the younger stuff. And we really don't know. But it's mainly dominated by this E horizon that's there. And that is a contemporary feature because of the perch water table. And we talked a little bit about this in the field. I showed you these hydrographs. And this is for the Fragiserel. So here's the label here, perched water table height. So think of zero as the top of the Fragipan. And then the top of the graph would represent the soil surface up here. You can see the horizonation here, AP, BW, BE, and E. And we talked about this on the field trip, how when you get rain, snow melt, you see these perch water tables really fluctuate quite a bit. And they do get up either at or very close to the soil surface on numerous occasions throughout the year, and that has a lot of environmental impacts for, particularly for fall applied nitrogen fertilizers and things like that. But the other thing too, if you look at the time down here, so November, December, January, February, March, April, May, these things hang around for a long time. The perched zones are fairly, they're variable from one year to the next, but they may be around for as much as 6 or 7 months out of the year. And that's what's kind of interesting, because you go out in this late summer, these things are bone dry, and those frangipans are really set up like a sidewalk almost. And you would never think about these soils having saturated conditions or being that wet, but they are pretty wet. And especially up here in the root zone and the layers up above the frangipan. But this perched water table is essentially what's responsible for the formation of an E-horizon. And so that's why I say those E-horizons are contemporary features, because of the loss of organic matter and iron oxides and even clays out of that E-horizon. And it can be lateral, in most cases, it's probably lateral on the sloping landscapes. So the water comes down, it hits the frangipan, can't move vertically, so it goes horizontally, and as it does that, it sort of strips out some of these pigmenting components and giving rise to the E-horizon. And the last one, I wanted to throw this in. This is an alfasol from up in Wisconsin, and you can see the profile over here. It looks like it's got a nice O-horizon there, probably an A-horizon underneath. Kind of looks like an E-horizon. And I suspect this is a BT, and this is probably a glacial till, maybe a 2 BT, something like that. But this figure is out of your book, and it shows the dynamics of the forest floor in one of these alfasols. So this is the weight of the OI horizon in kilograms per hectare, and then these are the months of the year. So this top curve is the amount, total amount or weight of leaves and woody debris that's on the soil surface, and then you can see it split out here with the dashed line being the leaves and the woody debris a little more constant. But you can see how the leaves really show this cyclical nature in terms of their amount. And the main reason for this are the earthworms that you see up there, because these earthworms have a lot of I think well-documented preferences for different types of leaves. And my major advisor spent, I think, 3 summers in Wisconsin out in the woods laying down on his stomach watching earthworms come up and pull these leaves down. And there really was an order in which these things would disappear, like the I can't remember how it goes, but maybe the maple are the most delectable, so they go first, and then the oak leaves go, and so on. So it's a particular order, but you can see how much this amount of leaf material above ground changes. And these earthworms are a primary reason that this organic material, these organic residues, get below the surface. And that's why you do see at least a little bit of an A horizon in there, because of the activity of them. Okay, I'm going to stop there. And on Thursday, take a look at the old tests. And if you have questions, why don't you bring them with you, and we'll spend the first part of lab going, or first part of lecture going over those. And then lab will take the quiz.